I appreciate that introduction and appreciate the chance to be here this evening. And I particularly thought Larry's remarks about the divisiveness of the act were appropriate, and I just wanted to make an initial comment about that before we proceeded on to talk about what it is. And I thought that the original federal judge who looked at this act actually got it right. This is Judge Vinson in Florida, one of the first district courts to look at the constitutionality of the individual mandate. This was that case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court a year ago last summer. He said, this case isn't about whether the act is wise or unwise legislation, or whether it will solve or exacerbate the myriad problems in our health system. In fact, it's not really about our health care system at all. It's principally about our federalist system, and it raises very important issues regarding the constitutional role of the federal government. So federalism, that's a code word for politics, right? He was telling us that really this is about politics. It's about what you feel the proper role of the federal government is, and people have very deep opinions, strongly held opinions about that, that aren't likely to change quickly. And so the act has aroused a lot of emotion and a lot of political debate. I thought Abraham Lincoln put it very well. The shepherd drives the wolf from the sheep's throat, for which the sheep thanks the shepherd as his liberator, while the wolf denounces him for the same act as the destroyer of liberty. Plainly, the sheep and the wolf are not agreed upon a definition of liberty. And that's exactly what's going on here. We're not agreed as a nation about the proper role of the federal government in health care. And that probably, you know, as you sat there and heard me talk about the wolf and the sheep, you actually pictured the wolf. And whoever you pictured tells you a lot about your politics. And those aren't likely to change tonight, so we don't really want to talk about that as much as talk about what the law is and what sort of big moving parts are. It's impossible in the brief amount of time we have to cover all the landscape, but we thought it would be helpful for me to focus on the five big insurance changes that are taking place beginning on January 1st, 2014. And this helps me to sort of get a mental framework for the conversation, and hopefully this will be helpful for you as well. The first one is everybody qualifies for coverage. The second, everyone is required to have coverage. The third, some people get financial help. Fourth, coverage and costs are changing. And fifth, there are new shopping choices, both where you can purchase insurance and the kinds of products that are available. And I want to briefly drill down on each of those five big changes. So the first one, everyone qualifies for coverage, represents really a sea change in the insurance industry. Beginning on January 1st, 2014, everybody gets insurance coverage regardless of their health status or their claims experience. It doesn't matter any longer whether you're sick or well. Everybody gets in. There are no more pre-existing condition exclusions. Your coverage can't be denied or delayed because of your health or your claims experience. You can't even have a waiting period of longer than 90 days. And in the individual and small employer markets, plans are community rated, which means they no longer take into account your health status when they're doing the rates as well. That guaranteed issue world is very different for the insurance community. There are people who were uninsurable today, and on January 1st, they get insurance. They're in the pool. The second point is the corollary to that. Because everyone qualifies for insurance, in order to have a insurance pool that is robust enough, everyone is required to have insurance, to have not just the sick, but also have the healthy in the insurance pool to bring down costs and make them affordable. So the second point is everyone is required. Well, mostly everyone. Of course, every rule has exceptions, and the exceptions here are those with religious objections, American Indians, those who are incarcerated, those for whom the lowest cost health coverage is more than 8% of their income, undocumented immigrants, and those with incomes below the filing threshold, because the penalty, which was litigated up to the Supreme Court, that's what the case was about, is actually instituted, applied as part of your individual income tax filing. And so if you don't file individual income taxes, the penalty doesn't apply to you, and hence the mandate doesn't apply to you either. But most Americans are required to have insurance or pay a penalty. And that penalty actually starts out very modest. In 2014, it's $95 per adult, $47.50 per child, up to a maximum of $285 per household, or 1% of the household income. And then those penalties increase over several years, and in 2016 and beyond, they cap out at $2,000 per household, or 2.5% of household income, and they increase by inflation after that. The other part about the requirement that everyone have coverage, and I'm slightly cheating on this to get it into the framework, is large employers are required to offer that coverage. And again here, the idea is to get that coverage to as many people as possible. And the large employer community is the way that many Americans receive their coverage today. And so there is a penalty for them to not offer sufficient coverage. We won't talk about those details here this evening. But this is a piece that has been delayed until 2015. And it's often referred to as the shared responsibility or large employer mandate. The idea is if the large employer doesn't offer adequate coverage to its full-time employees, then it will face a penalty. The third point is some people get financial help. And there's really a couple of different forms of this help. First of all, there's individual subsidies. And individual subsidies come in two flavors. There's help on the premium side, and there's also help on the cost share side. And we'll talk briefly about both of those. In addition to that, small employers get help as well. In the large employer market, the ACA uses the stick. And in the small employer market, so really up to 25 employees, up to 50 employees and less, in that small employee market, it's the carrot, which is they're trying to incentivize people, the small employer, to keep their health coverage. And by doing that, they offer a tax credit that actually is very attractive. It's been 35%. It goes up to 50% beginning in 2014. Only for 2 years, it's a transitional proposition. But small employers who have a very relatively small workforce with relatively low paid wages have the ability to get up to 50% of their premium reimbursed in the form of a tax credit from Uncle Sam. And again, that's designed to keep employer coverage. Let's talk about those individual subsidies, though. And the first one, and the one that you've heard the most about probably, is the advanced premium tax credit. So qualification for these subsidies. It's not available for those who get insurance through their work. So if you qualify for eligible employer coverage, you're not eligible for subsidies. It's not available for those who are covered by a public plan like Medicare, Medicaid, or CHIP. And you have to have an annual income that's between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level. To give you an idea, that upper level, the 400%, is actually very generous. 400% for a family of four is over $94,000 a year. For a single single individual household, that's $46,000 a year at 400%. So you're going beyond just low-income Americans. Fairly generous subsidies. Now, of course, at that high level at 400%, because they are on a sliding scale, the subsidies are not significant. But let me tell you a little bit about how that works. And this graph is hard to read, particularly for those of you who are listening on the radio. So let me try to describe this. The way the tax credit works is it's available at the point of purchase in the marketplace. And it's calculated as a percentage of your income. And so if your income is very low, let's say around 133% of federal poverty level, then the max premium that you have to pay is 2% of your income. For single coverage, that's 25 maximum dollars you have to pay per month. And for family of four, it would be $51. If your income is 150% of the federal poverty level, that goes up to 4%. And the maximum premium you'd pay is $56 for individual coverage and $115 for coverage for a family of four. And then the graph goes on. And so this is really a sliding scale again. But that amount is significant because that is all the consumer pays at the point of purchase. So in that example of someone who's at 150% of the federal poverty level, they only pay $56. It doesn't matter if their premium is $250. They don't see that. That money gets paid by the federal government on the back end to the insurance company. When they go to purchase insurance in the healthcare marketplace, the premium that they're actually charged is only $56. And so those subsidies are actually fairly significant. Now, for those who are not able, they're able, they receive that premium assistance, but now they have a high deductible, they may not be able to meet their deductible and their other cost share obligations. And so a premium assistance alone is not what this what the Act does. It provides premium assistance as well as a cost share reduction to help people who are low income with their deductibles and co-payments and co-insurance. And this chart shows you the way the Act accomplishes that is it increases the actuarial value of that insurance. For a typical silver plan in the marketplace, and you've probably heard in the media that the marketplace is divided up in metallic tiers. There's bronze coverage and silver coverage and gold and platinum. Silver coverage simply means that the actuarial split between the insurance company and the insured is 70-30. For gold, it's 80-20. For bronze, it's 60-40. And so for a silver plan, the person picks up 70% of the cost for that coverage, the insurance company picks up 70%, and the member picks up 30% through coinsurance, deductibles, copayments. What the cost-sharing reduction subsidies do is, and if you look at this chart, let's say you're at 150% of the federal poverty level, your actuarial value goes from 70% to 94%. So you pay through coinsurance, copayments, and deductibles only 6% of the cost of that coverage. The cost share is dramatically reduced for the individual consumer. And then you can see on the chart how that works out. So the first three categories, everybody qualifies, everybody is required, and some people get financial help. The fourth category is coverage and costs are changing. Let's talk about changes to coverage. You may have heard of essential health benefits. There's a mandated package of benefits that have to be covered by qualified health plans in the individual and small employer markets. That includes a defined list of preventive care services that have to be covered. Maternity is now mandated for the first time in the individual and small employer markets. And mental health and substance abuse treatment is required. Mental health parity law only applied to large employers until now. On January 1st, 2014, it applies to the small employer community as well. And you could list a lot of other things that are in that defined set of benefits, but that's what essential health benefits is about. There are no more annual or lifetime dollar limits. Many insurance companies had $1 million or $2 million or $2.5 million lifetime caps. Those are gone. They've been phased out over the last several years. And then deductible and out-of-pocket costs are capped as well. For small employer coverage, it's a $2,000 individual and $4,000 for family coverage. And for all coverage, individual and small employer, whether it's insured or self-funded, the out-of-pocket maximum is $63.50 for single and $12.7 for family. That total out-of-pocket maximum is capped at those levels, so people don't have to pay any more than that out-of-pocket, regardless of how expensive their conditions are. So that's coverage. Coverage is getting generally better. What is going to change costs? And specifically, what's going to cause costs to go up? Well, all that expanded coverage we just described, first of all. When you have that richer, more robust coverage, of course, costs are going to go up along with that. Secondly, those high-risk individuals who used to be uninsurable are coming into the insurance pool, and because of that, that generally is going to put upward pressure on insurance rates as well. So those who were previously uninsured or covered by the high-risk pool are going to make rates more expensive. What's going to cause premiums to fall? That's a trick question. Premiums don't fall. For those of you in radio land, there's a photo of hell freezing over. Premiums don't fall. They only have a lower rate of increase. It's kind of like the national debt. Actually, that's typically true, but that's not true in this circumstance. There will be those for whom insurance costs are actually lower under the Affordable Care Act, and those are those who qualify for those fairly generous federal subsidies. Many of those will actually have lower insurance costs. And as well as that, in addition to that, those who previously paid high premiums because of their health condition or age may see a net decrease in their health insurance costs. Generally speaking, however, there's upward pressure on rates because of the factors that I just described. Okay, the fifth category. There are new shopping choices, and this involves several things. First of all, you've heard that the Act actually mandated that Medicaid be expanded in all 50 states up to 133% of the federal poverty level, regardless of whether or not you have children or don't. For most people, in Medicaid today is only for families with children. So that was the part that came out of the Supreme Court case that was the big change. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, but decided that it was not constitutional to coerce the states to expand Medicaid coverage. And so now that's permissive to every state. Every state gets to decide whether or not to expand their Medicaid coverage up to 133% of federal poverty level. I dare say there are some questions out there about that tonight, and we can drill down and talk about that. Utah's decision is still pending, hasn't been made. There have been a lot of people working on that. There is also the health insurance marketplace, and I'm going to talk briefly about that before closing in a moment. But this is this new place where you can comparison shop and purchase healthcare coverage. And then there are also new products. There's a new catastrophic plan, the offer to the young invincibles to try to get them to get health insurance and be in the marketplace and help bring down costs. So let's briefly update you on, and its technical name is the federally facilitated marketplace is what we have here in Utah. You can have a state-administered marketplace or federally facilitated. And actually here in Utah, we have both, because what we have is our individual marketplace is federally facilitated, run by the federal government. And our small employer marketplace is Utah's very own, you know, used to be called the Utah Health Insurance Exchange. Now it's called Avenue H. And we received permission as a state under the ACA from the federal government to have Avenue H be our small employer marketplace, our ACA qualifying marketplace. And so we have one of the only two states in the union that has that bifurcated marketplace, sort of a mixed model. But I want to talk briefly about that marketplace. On October 1st, as you know, when everyone anxiously got online and kicked open healthcare.gov, this is what they first saw. And then, of course, if they pushed any other button, this is what they next saw. You know, the system is down at the moment. We're working to resolve the issue as soon as possible. Please try again later. And that was well publicized, and there was a lot of frustration and a lot of angst, a lot of tears, not just for consumers, for insurance companies as well, I assure you. And so I wanted to make some observations about how that's going and what has happened in the federally facilitated marketplace. And then, again, we will have time for questions, and I dare say there's questions on that as well. The first point is there is still plenty of time. These deadlines have been extended now, and the fact that it wasn't working before is not an impediment now for people to go online and enroll. The deadlines are as follows. You have until December 23rd, which is an extension, it used to be December 15th, to enroll in coverage that will be effective on January 1st. So if your goal is to get insurance coverage, you don't have it now, and you want it for January 1st, you have until December 23rd to go in and enroll online. The deadline to avoid the penalty has also been extended. You have until the end of March to enroll and avoid that individual penalty for not having insurance. That used to be the middle of February, but that's been extended until the end of that open enrollment period at the end of March. The second observation is that many of us thought, there was a lot of talk about the mandate, you know, the tax penalty driving enrollment, but many of us thought that subsidies would be actually the bigger driver and that they actually should be driving a lot of people to get coverage in the marketplace. I saw a statistic that said single person households between the ages of 18 and 34, almost half of them are eligible across the nation for a bronze level plan with a premium of $50 or less. And that's the subsidies at work. That at $100, that number goes up to 66%. 66% of those single individuals between 18 and 34 are eligible for coverage at $100 or less. And so that's very generous coverage. That should be driving the volume. The problem has been people couldn't get in and sign up. And that is changing the game. It's changed the game politically. It's changed the game functionally. It's done damage to the ACA that the politics over 3 or 4 years didn't. And the mere fact that the system was dysfunctional has created more problems for ACA implementation than the politics ever did. So there's breaking news from the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. The federal small employer marketplace has been delayed for a year. That doesn't affect Utah. We have Avenue H. It's up and running. They wisely didn't open the doors on their 2014 enrollment until they were ready for it to work electronically, and that's good news for Utah. But the rest of the nation actually won't have an online shop marketplace for another year. So, you know, you saw the headlines, and in the question and answer period, we can talk more about this, but we're at a critical junction. The administration promised that the marketplace would be significantly better by the end of November, 1st of December, and the calendar tells us that it's December 2nd. And the marketplace has definitely improved. The question will be, you know, whether or not those improvements are sufficient for people to be able to enroll and for that information to get to the carriers. Pretty much everyone who's attempted now reports that it is easier to get online, to stay online, and to enroll in coverage. And we're encouraging people to go do that. There may still be bandwidth issues. The administration announced at the end of November that they can now take up to 50,000 users simultaneously, 50,000 users simultaneously. They also announced today that they had over 300,000 people online today. And so it'll be interesting to see how that works and whether or not the functionality stays there. If those improvements are sufficient, then the implementation of the Affordable Care Act will probably proceed apace. If they're not, if it isn't functional and the people cannot get in and enroll and that information is not getting accurately transferred to insurance companies, I think you can expect more announcements and more legislative developments and maybe some more regulatory developments about potentially delaying other aspects of the act, potentially even the individual mandate. And so this is a very critical time, and it will be very interesting over the next week or two to watch and see how effective that is. There is so much more that could be said, but not enough time to do it, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to answer your questions. I've tried to create that big picture framework of what this is trying to accomplish, and then I'm happy to drill down during the question and answer period, and I really appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I'm sure that answered every question here, right? Probably not.